There have been reports about Wikipedia being banned in Iran and so on. We're actively monitoring that through the Open Net Initiative. I think the reaction initially will be, among some countries anyway, a more aggressive posture towards internet censorship. They'll try to find ways to attack and bring down Siphon.
Here's a story where the people trying to prevent content from being blocked aren't the spammers. They're with Citizen Lab, and they're trying to keep the free flow of information on the web available to everyone on the planet. Also, we go to the LA Auto Show, where the theme is Tech My Ride. This is PodTech News Weekly Magazine for Saturday, December 9th, 2006. I'm Jason Lopez. Over the last months, IBM, Nortel, HP, and now Cisco Systems have announced that they're expanding or setting up operations in India. Cisco said Wednesday it will triple its workforce in India and set up a globalization center in Bangalore, India's technology hub. The network equipment maker plans to invest $1.1 billion in India, CEO John Chambers told this to reporters last week. PodTech's Catherine Girardot talks about these developments with a Stanford professor who studies the history of high-tech development.
India is home to some of the fastest-growing high-tech centers in the world. On today's show, I'll talk with Margaret O'Meara, a Stanford University historian whose first book, Cities of Knowledge, is a history of Silicon Valley. With her collaborator, Stanford geographer Karen Seto, O'Meara is currently researching the economic and environmental impacts of high-tech boomtowns in India.
What does it mean when you transplant the suburban-style development to developing nations, to the outskirts of Bangalore? What does it mean when you have a place that has so many more people to support per acre? What does it mean when you say, well, we're just going to keep on building out and out and out to the outskirts, and that's where high technology is going to be? It's going to be 30 kilometers outside the city center because that's the only place we have room to build these kind of developments.
This is the PodTech Weekly, a production of PodTech News. I'm Catherine Girardot. I asked Margaret O'Meara what she saw during her fieldwork in India as the major challenges for companies setting up shop in Bangalore.
Bangalore is a city built for 1 million people that now has 6 million people, and it has completely outgrown its infrastructure, which in and of itself has some pretty significant economic and environmental effects. The traffic there is just, I've never experienced anything like it. You've never seen gridlock till you've been to Bangalore. It's really incredible what they're struggling with there, and the kind of public sector infrastructure has just not been able to accommodate it.
And how much of a role do you think that the companies locating facilities there will have in being able to influence local governments? I know in India,
Yeah. You
know, it's definitely not quick or easy to get things done at a local governmental level.
Yes, that was a nice understatement. I think it depends on the size of the company. The Microsofts, the Oracles, the Dells seem to play very different roles in being able to influence public sector elites, influence these bigger trends than these smaller to mid-sized companies, in part because Oracle comes in and you're building a campus for Oracle. They're not just a tenant in a larger office park development. Also, we need to think about the Indian high-tech giants as well as being important players in this. It isn't just all American companies that are making a difference here. You could see these larger firms having the platform, the soapbox, on which to influence local land use decisions.
O'Meara's research on Silicon Valley outlines the suburban office park near a research university that often characterizes high-tech development. But that model, both here in the U.S. and in developing countries like India, has significant impact, environmental and otherwise. Margaret O'Meara.
So there are these two dimensions, land consumption / energy consumption, as a result of the built environment that high-tech tends to inhabit, and then the actual polluting activities caused by technology. What's happening in Bangalore, because of these infrastructure deficiencies generally, is that firms that are coming over there, American firms, multinational firms, are coming into research park developments that have their own electric generators, that are providing their own electricity, their own water, their own services. And that is not without its environmental impacts. And there are just not a lot of regulations in place. You know, when cities grow really, really fast, there's not a lot of time to do environmental remediation.
O'Mara concedes that foreign and even larger Indian companies are becoming increasingly aware of their environmental impact and, in the absence of government regulations, are beginning to regulate themselves.
And I think as labor costs go up in India and the margins between, you know, how much it costs to hire an Indian engineer in India versus an engineer in Santa Clara or Cupertino, I think that these quality of life factors are going to become increasingly more important, and local governments are going to have to recognize those.
But O'Mara is also seeing something different happening in high-tech developments in India, something that the United States could learn from.
You know, I was sort of seeing this as a transplant story, and to many degrees it is. Like when you drive out to some of the industrial tech parks on the outskirts of Bangalore and you look at these buildings, you say, I could be in, put in name of Silicon Valley City here. But then you shift your gaze a few feet to the right of this building, and the urban context can be very different. First of all, you don't have this sort of American-style zoning where the U.S. is really good at zoning everything out that isn't, you know, intended to be in that space. And in Bangalore, you might have a squatter settlement next door. You will have kind of chaotic street scene right next to this gleaming new research park. So you have this interesting, I wouldn't call it a transplantation, it's more like a transmutation, where you have what's growing in Bangalore is, it's imitating Silicon Valley, sort of it's a conscious imitation, but it's also very, I think, essentially Indian. It's very much shaped, I think, by political culture, by the culture itself. And I think that actually could present some very interesting opportunities for a more sustainable model of high-tech growth.
O'Mara concludes that despite the inconveniences of traffic congestion, high housing costs, and inadequate infrastructure, talent and companies will keep coming.
People come to Bangalore because other people are in Bangalore. American firms, sort of small to mid-sized U.S. tech firms are coming to Bangalore because the big U.S. tech firms are in Bangalore. The engineers who graduate from IIT and other elite universities in India are going to Bangalore because that's where the jobs are and that's where people they know are. And the ecology of high-tech boom towns is interesting because you can get away with a lot of inconveniences when you have the talent and the money there.
Bangalore and other burgeoning Asian Silicon Valleys are lands of opportunity of the moment for high-tech companies, local and foreign. And for now, the advantages of affordable land, talent, and welcoming governments far outweigh the economic and infrastructure challenges.
But not for the long term. Long term, you got to fix something. And it'll be very interesting and important what happens in Indian cities, Bangalore, and other places that are becoming high-tech capitals, Hyderabad, Chennai, Pune, over the next 5-10 years, what local governments, regional governments, national governments, and business leaders do to think about the shape of urban growth and what its economic impact is going to be and what its environmental impact is going to be.
In San Francisco, I'm Catherine Girardeau, PodTech News.
In recent years, countries such as China, Iran, and Saudi Arabia have made headlines in the tech pages for being among the most aggressive countries in the world when it comes to filtering internet content. The Open Net Initiative is out to expose the ways and means such countries use to police the net. ONI, as it's called, is a collaborative partnership of Harvard University, Cambridge and Oxford Universities in the UK, and the University of Toronto in Canada. The Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto has recently gone beyond merely documenting internet filtering. The lab has created a new kind of tool to help people circumvent it. PodTech's Clark Boyd reports.
The Citizen Lab has spent the past 5 years helping ONI figure out how certain countries keep their citizens from fully accessing the Internet. But at the same time, the lab has also learned some interesting things about the way people in those countries get around that kind of censorship. Ron Diebert is director of the Citizen Lab.
If you look at, for example, in a case like China, the primary way in which people get around Internet censorship is by searching for and connecting to open public proxies. These are computers that are set up in countries where there is no Internet censorship, and their connection information is publicized in some manner, either on a forum or through the radio or email, to citizens who then connect to these proxy computers and surf the web freely. The biggest weaknesses of those types of circumvention are that, first of all, you don't know who's setting up these proxy computers. It could be the government that you're trying to evade, monitoring your use. Most of them happen in plain text. In other words, the connection information is not secure. So anybody monitoring the connections between users and those proxies could isolate and identify a person getting around Internet censorship, which of course could get people in trouble. And also, they're very difficult often to use. On the server side, on the proxy side, there's a high level of computer skill required to set up one of these proxies. And then lastly, because the method of telling people about it is to publicize the addresses to these proxies, as soon as they're publicized, governments can put them on a block list.
So, Diebert says, some of the researchers at the Citizen Lab started thinking about ways to make a better circumvention technology. The project moved along in fits and starts. The lab didn't have the money to complete it. But then in January of this year, the Open Society Institute gave the lab some money. Last week, the lab finally released its program. It's called PSIPHON. That's PSIPHON. Ron Diebert says PSIPHON is a circumvention technology of a different stripe.
First of all, it's based on social networks of trust. We have people in uncensored locations downloading and installing PSIPHON on their home computers and then giving the connection information to only a few trusted friends and family members. And that avoids the problem of states discovering and finding out about and blocking the proxy servers. We also made PSIPHON very simple and easy to set up. Anybody can install this on their home computer. You don't need to be a computer geek to be able to set this up. And lastly, the connection between the user and the server is encrypted over an HTTPS connection. So, in effect, PSIPHON traffic is buried within volumes of global financial flows that take place daily over the Internet.
The one really interesting part of this is, I think, is the social networking aspect of it and tapping into that. Can you talk a little bit more about that and why the decision was made to go about things that way?
It's actually the social networks of trust that provides the strongest safety mechanism for PSIPHON. It's not technological at all. It's that you set up PSIPHON on your home computer and you only have a few friends or family members that know about the address and the username and the password, know it even exists, who connect to it. And as long as that social network of trust remains below the radar, it's virtually impossible for governments to find out and block that connection. And when you think about, you know, who would be the people that make up these social networks of trust, the type of communities that exist out there that would have a need for this is enormous. First of all, you have ethnic diaspora communities, Chinese Americans, Chinese Canadians, Iranian Americans, Iranian Canadians. Any group of people or set of individuals who have connections between censored and uncensored countries and who want to exercise their basic human rights will want to make use of PSIPHON. And I think that's precisely why it's spread so fast in the last few days.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that. What's been the reaction since you've released it?
The reaction has been beyond our wildest expectations, actually. People are very interested in learning about PSIPHON because I think there is a growing appreciation of the problem of Internet censorship worldwide. When we started out our research here in the Citizen Lab with the Open Net Initiative, we were looking only at three or four countries that were known to be actively censoring Internet traffic: China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and so forth. Now we're monitoring upwards of 40 countries, so the problem is growing, and I think PSIPHON has been so well received because people appreciate that there is this growing problem.
So we've had 40,000 downloads of Siphon. That's 40,000 Siphon nodes that have popped up around the world since we released it on December 1st.
How do you expect the growth to be there? Do you expect it to slow down, or do you think, you know, once 40,000 people download it, they tell four of their friends, and suddenly you've got sort of an exponential thing on your hands?
Yeah, I think that's starting to happen, actually. And the moment we released the software, a couple of things happened that were interesting. One, Iran immediately banned access to the Siphon site, which is ironic because those aren't the people we want downloading Siphon. It's the people in uncensored countries who we want to download Siphon, who then give the connection information to their friends and family members in Iran. The other thing that happened was that we created a forum, and immediately it was populated with people providing solutions to bugs to each other, setting up communities, forums of their own, exchanging ideas, translating Siphon into Farsi and Chinese. So what's happened is that just as Siphon is based on social networks of trust, capitalizing on this kind of social networking phenomenon of the internet, these communities out there are taking Siphon and using it in ways we didn't anticipate and really running with it. So it's kind of now taken off beyond us in ways that we really appreciate and applaud.
And it's free, right? People can download it for free.
It's free, and it's also open source. We're working on the code base now. We're going to put it up so that those who want to look at and modify the code can.
Basing a network on trust, I guess the one weakness you could think of here would be that somebody who's actually not very trustworthy gets into a trusted network somehow. Is there any thought about how to deal with that situation?
All we can tell people is that you have to know and trust the person who's offering you access through a Siphon node, and you also have to trust the people who you are offering access to if you set up a Siphon node. That doesn't mean there won't be instances where, for example, an adversary or a bad government is going to try to set up a Siphon node and lure people. In fact, I expect that to happen. However, Siphon nodes aren't connected to each other. So even if that happens in one case, it only brings down that one Siphon node user relationship. It doesn't bring down the Siphon system as a whole. But that's the wonderful thing about social networks is, you know, it's not a technological failure. If Siphon fails, it's because of failure of social network, and you really can't control that. That's up to individuals themselves.
In doing your research about filtering, how does the release of Siphon sort of dovetail with what you're doing there, and do you expect to see changes in the sort of filtering that you'll see from countries?
I mentioned Iran started to block the Siphon website, and it also has coincidentally perhaps started much more aggressively filtering internet traffic over the last few days. There have been reports about Wikipedia being banned in Iran and so on. We're actively monitoring that through the Open Net Initiative. I think the reaction initially will be, among some countries anyway, a more aggressive posture towards internet censorship. They'll try to find ways to attack and bring down Siphon. But we're pretty confident, based on the research expertise we have here in the Citizen Lab and among our partners worldwide, especially at Cambridge University, who've been helping vet the program, that it is a resilient system. It's a resilient concept. So I just, as of now anyway, I can't see a way in which governments can block it. So I see this as an enormous boost to protecting human rights online and providing people with a means to access information and exercise their freedom of speech. So we're very encouraged.
Because you would be a little bit worried if you released something out there and then it actually ended up leading to more censorship rather than less censorship.
I think it could in some cases, but over the long run, I think what will happen is states may try to react against it by implementing more aggressive internet censorship filtering systems, but citizens, through technology like Siphon, it's not the only one, are finding ways to get around it. And, you know, where that battle ends up in the long run, I'm not sure, but I'm hoping the balance has been tipped by Siphon in the direction of openness and access to information.
Ron, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's Ron Diebert, director of the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. You can find out more about Siphon and download it at psiphon.civisec, that's civisec.org. In Boston, this is Clark Boyd for PodTech News.
Design and technology coming together with automobiles. That was evident at the LA Auto Show this past week. It was the 100th anniversary of the show and held at the Los Angeles Convention Center. PodTech's Matt Kelly was there and files this report.
The event showcased 1,000 of the newest cars, trucks, and SUVs from automakers, including production and concept cars, and a record 35 world or North American debuts that featured some of the most advanced engineering of the future. At center stage were alternative fuel technologies, as some of the largest brands unveiled their plans for environmentally sustainable vehicles, including Honda's FCX and BMW's Hydrogen 7. But perhaps the most anticipated announcement came from the world's largest automaker, General Motors. The company has had some mixed news of late. The automaker lost its biggest investor when billionaire Kirk Kerkorian sold all his shares in the company, while Bank of America took a 5% stake in the company, valued at $800 million. Yet General Motors continues to lose market share to Japan's Toyota Motor Corporation, which analysts expect to inevitably assume the role of the world's biggest automaker before long. To compete, GM will have to start making money on small cars and develop the alternative fuel technologies that already account for approximately 28% of Toyota's U.S. sales. Perhaps because of that, GM's chairman of the board, Rick Wagner, announced plans to bring a plug-in hybrid vehicle to market during the show's keynote address.
General Motors has begun work on a Saturn View plug-in hybrid production vehicle. The technological hurdles are real, but we believe they're surmountable. I can't give you a date certain at this point for our plug-in hybrid, but I can tell you that this is a top priority program for General Motors, given the huge potential it offers for fuel economy improvement.
While no timetable was given, the announcement was the first time GM said in public it plans to introduce a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, or PHEV, although rumors had been swirling for some time. Wagner said it will use a two-mode hybrid system, plug-in technology, and a lithium-ion battery pack. But production will be heavily dependent on battery technology development. For more about the company's plans, I spoke with Mickey Bly, GM's Director of Engineering for Hybrid Vehicles, who said the company has long had this commitment to vehicles fueled by alternative energy.
We've introduced flex fuel actually 20 years ago that most people don't realize, introducing E10 capability on all of our General Motors vehicles back in the late 80s. We've upped that by being able to go to E85 or 85% ethanol, and today we've committed to double our production of E85 capable vehicles by 2010, and then even increase that further by 2012.
Bly continues to say it's all part of GM's plans to diversify energy consumption in automobiles.
What we've been doing is trying to get a strategic rollout of our propulsion technology and diversifying the energy sources. And in the future, the energy demands of the world is going to be significantly increasing, and we need to provide a lot of different avenues of energy supply to support our automotive, and we're doing that through biofuels, we're doing that through hybrid electric vehicles, and then the plug-in even gets you one more step because you're taking energy off the grid.
GM appears to be dedicating significant resources to vehicles powered by alternative fuels, unveiling both the Saturn View Green Line Hybrid and a new hydrogen fuel cell production vehicle, the Chevy Equinox. Julie Beamer, GM's Director of Fuel Cell Commercialization, noted the Equinox isn't a concept vehicle and that plans for comprehensive testing of it in three major U.S. cities are coming as part of the company's Project Driveway.
This is the first comprehensive market test of a fuel cell vehicle, and so we will have hundreds of people that will be utilizing these vehicles typically on a three-month basis so that they can use them in their daily lives. And we're going to have mainstream drivers, business drivers, media, celebrities, politicians that will be driving these vehicles to get us comprehensive learnings on all aspects of their driving experience. The Equinox fuel cell vehicles will be deployed in the Washington, D.C. area, the New York City metropolitan area, and then here in California. Now, we've not said definitively where, but certainly the Southern California, Greater Los Angeles area, in large degree due to the availability of refueling, hydrogen refueling.
Beamer says the sites were chosen for their driving conditions as well as their climates and diversity of consumers.
The three locations were chosen to give us a diversity of climatic conditions, a diversity of driving conditions, but also a diversity of consumers who will be driving these vehicles, because we want a very comprehensive understanding of not only how the vehicle performs, but importantly, how consumers react to the experience of hydrogen and fuel cell technology.
But what has to occur in order for these vehicles to be deemed a success and to help the fortunes of GM? Experts identify three areas of concern: refueling infrastructure and battery technology, both of which will have to keep pace and could be several years away before widespread adoption occurs. But perhaps, and most importantly, they identify consumer demand for these vehicles that will ensure their introduction and, in the end, the future of General Motors. In Los Angeles, I'm Matt Kelly for PodTech News.
That's PodTech News, produced by Matt Kelly, Clark Boyd, and Catherine Girardeau. I'm Jason Lopez. Thanks for listening. Check out our daily news brief, MP3, at podtech.net/news.